what we are seeing now, appointing a secular, non-Muslim sort of lawyer all the way in sort of north of England to run and to sort of dictate what should happen in a mosque and in a charity, it really is outrageous.
It all started with a warning from the charity regulator over a vigil held here in 2020 for revered Iranian military commander General Qasem Soleimani, assassinated in a U.S. drone attack in Baghdad, Iraq, in the same year. The man who spoke at the event says no laws were broken.
Sardar Soleimani wasn't prescribed, or the organization he worked for wasn't prescribed, and he's still not prescribed. He was sanctioned, financial sanction, for issue of Syria. Now, when somebody dies and you talk about that person, you're not supporting financially the person. He's already dead. You know, there is no issue of breaking the sanction. It's outrageous that a charity commission, an organization we're supposed to support, will actually become so political that actually sort of misinterprets the law.
In the early 2000s, the British government and the Charity Commission initiated a program calling on all UK mosques to become registered charity. And by doing so, critics say, control what those Muslim institutions could or could not say outside of what is lawful.
We reached out to the authorities here, but they declined to comment. We were told unofficially, though, that the real reason behind the temporary closure of the center, done on the advice of the interim manager, was something to do with insurance, which they hope would be resolved and the doors to the center reopened to the public soon. Saeed Purizep, London.
Lebanon has marked the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from Israeli occupation. On this year's anniversary, Beirut was seen to a conference on the resistance front's fight against the world arrogance. The meeting, held by the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance, was attended by guests from over 60 countries. The four-day congregation's theme is the resilience of the axis of resistance and its role in breaking the siege, ending sanctions, and overthrowing normalization.
This is more than necessary now to unite the people against this American-Israel aggression, because we have the same problem everywhere. You know this very good from the Middle East. I'm from Serbia. We know it as well from the Balkans. But now they start to attack the other European countries because they only use terrorism, like they kill General Soleimani.
Some participants said the liberation of southern Lebanon in 2000 and other victories for the resistance front in the last few decades are catalysts for a shift to a multipolar world.
Definitely, there's been a huge change in the world. First, because of the strength of the resistance in our region and the defeat of the American troops in Iraq, Afghanistan, in Lebanon, in Syria. This is now infecting the whole world in hope to escape American hegemony. So we see even this shift of multipolarity actually started because of the resistance in our region.
Western guests present in the conference believe there is growing awareness on the need for resistance against arrogant powers.
The awareness itself is shaped by resistance. So the actual victories in Palestine, in Syria, in Cuba, in Venezuela, these are the things that really shape people's consciousness. But we in the gathering here want to reinforce the values that people have a proper understanding of the importance of the centrality of resistance for human liberation.
An attendee said the resistance front is capable of putting an end to the Israeli regime's relentless atrocities against Palestinians.
Israel has become now a fascist regime. Israel has become a barbaric and a racist and a totalitarian regime. That is the only country in the world which has been supported by Western hegemony and also NATO. But their time, it is nearer. And the resistance and the people of the world, through the international solidarity movement, they will find ways to dismantle the Israeli apartheid regime.
The delegations will be taking a tour to villages in southern Lebanon. They will also pay an official visit to Syria to show solidarity with Damascus in the face of U.S. sanctions. Major transformations in recent years have caused more and more people to resonate with the values of resistance. Participants here consist of not only Lebanese and Palestinians, but people from around the world who are against the aggressive policies of Israel and the United States. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A successful first launch operation. Iran has test-fired its most advanced ballistic missile. The fourth-generation Khorramshahr-class long-range ballistic missile dubbed Khaybar is a liquid-fueled precision-guided missile that can carry a 1,500-kilogram warhead and accurately hit targets 2,000 kilometers farther.
Khorramshahr 4 is the developed version of previous models and is a stealth missile. It can easily bypass enemy air defenses due to its low radar cross-section. It is the result of years of hard work of our engineers at the Aerospace Industries Organization. With its impressive tactical capabilities, the Khorramshahr 4 missile shows that we are fully committed to defending our country.
Khorramshahr 4 has a unique guidance and control system, which allows it to adjust its trajectory as it travels through outer space. The system is deactivated as it re-enters the atmosphere. This important feature makes Khorramshahr 4 missiles fully immune to any kind of electronic warfare counterattacks. The newly unveiled missile also has an incredibly short preparation and launch time, and thanks to its liquid-fueled engine, the missile can easily reach hypersonic speeds of Mach 16 in outer space and Mach 8 traveling through the Earth's atmosphere. This makes detecting and tracking the missile impossible, which means it is totally invisible to radars.
When we talk about our defense capabilities, the name Khorramshahr stands for self-reliance and sacrifice, the two qualities that lead to the liberation of the city of Khorramshahr back in 1982. So this type of missile is rightfully named Khorramshahr. And the fourth generation that was unveiled today marks a significant advancement in Iran's ballistic missile technology while enhancing its defense capabilities and deterrence. This is good news for our nation. All of this is happening on the 41st anniversary of the liberation of the southwestern city of Khorramshahr during the Iran-Iraq War, a major turning point that tipped the scales in Iran's favor, designating the word Khorramshahr as a code name for victory, perseverance, and self-reliance.
And what better way to celebrate the liberation anniversary of the city of Khorramshahr than by unveiling this ballistic missile? Khorramshahr 4 is a precision-guided missile which is considered a symbol of determination and self-sufficiency. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
After an intense year of deadly fighting between the Russian and Ukrainian armed forces, Bakhmut and nearby villages have reportedly been seized by Moscow, being an important roadway and industrial center with huge underground salt mines and with a pre-war population of 75,000. Bakhmut, also known as Artyomovsk in Russia, is located about 60 kilometers north of Donetsk, the regional capital of Donbas. The city has been so largely devastated that there are almost no intact buildings left in it. Over 3,500 residents of Bakhmut Artyomovsk have been evacuated and placed in a facility in the neighboring town of Shakhtyrsk.
We left on May 20th, the day of liberation, because the city had been razed so thoroughly that living was impossible. Its destruction continues in this very moment. The level of danger is even higher than 1 to 2 months ago. This is our Stalingrad, but DPR acting head Pushilin has pledged that the city will be reconstructed and restored. We hope it will happen very soon.
Here at the Shakhtar's temporary accommodation center, there are people that fled the unprecedented bloody battles in Bakhmut in recent days. They survived bullets and strikes hitting their towns, but now they have to face a life in ruins.
Most families from Bakhmut Artyomovsk left months ago as fighting in the city became vicious, but now, after several hundred of civilians, including children, have lost their lives, even those who vowed to stay to the end are leaving, according to Shakhtarsk mayor. About 60 Bakhmut residents arrived in his town on Sunday, and as many will be transferred there shortly.
We spent 1 month hiding in the basement. It was horrible. While the Ukrainian soldiers were shelling our house, I was with my old mother. We never ever got out of our shelter. My mother was losing her mind. She saw things that were not there. One day she was even about to run out of the basement to put an end to her nightmare.
I've been a pensioner for 13 years, conducting a serene life, living with my mother. Our problems began 9 years ago, and we have to thank God if we are still alive today.
Russian forces now face the task of seizing the remaining part of the Donetsk region still under Ukrainian control, including several heavily fortified areas. Meanwhile, fighting around Donetsk is ongoing. Max Civili, Donetsk.
On May 24th of the year 2000, Lebanese masses flocked to their hometowns and villages in a surprise move that shocked the Israeli army and sent the Israeli collaborators fleeing towards northern occupied Palestine. These towns witnessed over 18 years of Israeli occupation, terrorism, killing and destruction. Thanks to the strategy of attrition adopted by the resistance movement, the Israeli army was left with no option but to withdraw unconditionally from the land it had occupied. Since then, Lebanon has celebrated May 25th as a national day of resistance and liberation.
We earned our freedom. It wasn't like they said, oh, we left. No, they didn't left. We make them leave.
Hassan was forced to leave his hometown during the Israeli occupation. He recalls how terrorized he was as a child when the Israelis first invaded South Lebanon.
I was forced to leave my land on 1982, and I was unable to come back until after 2000. It was a great moment. I can tell the difference, like when we used to drive or when we was kids, my parents used to say, don't look, don't smile, don't do nothing, don't breathe even. That's how much we were scared.
Today he brings his son to see the fruit of years of struggle.
After hard work and all the suffering that the army of Hezbollah and went through and fought hard and freed the South Lebanon, Jnoub. And now I can hear with my friends, five of them, all from Canada. They wanted to get a good vacation. We didn't know where to go. And I asked my dad, and he's like, Lebanon, you have to go to Lebanon. Now it's free, beautiful country.
Of course, it shows the strength, of course, of the community and how you can't take something that, you know, rightfully belongs to someone. And honestly, just overall, it's been beautiful so far here, and it just really shows how much love there is in the city.
After, you know, withdrawal in 2000, you can see the smile in the face of the people, especially the children. They can, and they can play, and they can walk around in peace, and they are really happy to go to come back to their homeland, which we really paid a lot of blood to get it back. And we are looking forward, really, for the Palestinians to live and to have the same feeling as we feel.
The fruit of liberation is seen by the people of Lebanon as a natural outcome of resistance, and they have voiced their support and encouragement to the Palestinian people that someday they too will be free. Maryam Saleh, Odaisi, South Lebanon.
Across France, top unions led another day of strikes aimed at winning the revocation of a recent 2-year hike to the retirement age. With President Emmanuel Macron refusing to budge, many are now demanding the movement expand into a complete general strike.
We must have a general strike to create a new system of society, as our current model allows the government and the bosses to totally ignore our needs. everybody must get involved because everybody is affected.
Many speculate that Macron is so isolated from everyday French society that he may not understand how resentful the public mood is following one austerity measure after another since 2010.
Macron doesn't listen to us, but what's worse is that he looks down on us. He still doesn't care about all the protesting, so that's why our goal has to be to block the entire economy with a general strike. That will get his attention.
The general strike of 2019-2020 was the nation's longest labor action ever, but it ultimately failed. The strike shaved only 0.1% off of French economic growth that quarter, showing that a general strike's most powerful aspect may be its ability to shame and discredit those in power. The biggest economic impact of striking is felt by the workers. The pre-COVID general strike failed because so many workers were just too impoverished to continue a strike that had lasted almost 2 months.
The government did all it could to stretch the general strike out, as their plan was to exhaust the strikers financially. They're using the same tactic now, and that's why we saw more than 4 months of massive protests before they even met with unions to discuss the wage hike.
This spring has seen record strikes in other European nations, such as Belgium, Germany, Spain, and even the United Kingdom. Low salaries, record inflation, and perceptions that their governments refuse to democratically recognize the scope of the hardship are all consistently cited as reasons. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Protests in Europe are continuing unabated. This time, thousands of teachers and healthcare professionals have taken to the streets in the Spanish capital, Madrid, demanding better pay and working conditions. This can be applied to other countries in Europe, like the UK and France. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether European governments have efficient economic game plans when it comes to resolving their citizens' problems, or will they blindly support the Ukraine war, which has been one of the factors that has led to European economic miseries. First, let me introduce our correspondent from Brussels, Jerome Hughes, who joins us to give us the latest on this. Well, Jerome, you have another strike action, and protest, I should say, or combined, perhaps you can tell us, this happening in Spain, and I believe also one in Italy. Give us what you have on this.
That's right, Covey, and many more planned as well, because we have record high employment in the EU, which is a good news story. The problem is there are far too many poor quality jobs, so you have a situation whereby lots of people, millions of people, are on the minimum wage. The minimum wage is certainly not keeping up with very high inflation, and workers are sick and tired. Just because you have full employment, it doesn't tell the full story. The situation is that the cost of living crisis continues to be out of control. You have inflation higher in some EU member states than others, and you have a situation whereby people cannot pay their rents, cannot pay their mortgages. Just a few days ago, the European Central Bank celebrated its 25th anniversary, and Christine Lagarde was there cutting an enormous cake. And on social media, she received scathing criticism, because people are saying that these people at the top of the tree, earning huge salaries, they're completely out of touch with ordinary people, ordinary people who are struggling to heat their homes at night when it does get colder, even at this time of year, and also struggling to put food on the table. Interest rates keep going up, inflation remains very high, and we have the situation whereby we have the latest figure, €65 billion has been sent to Ukraine from the EU alone. €65 billion.
All right, thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. Jerome Hughes there from Brussels, a correspondent. Thank you for that update.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight now. Clive Menzies, political economy researcher and analyst, joins us from London. And Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, joins us from Brussels. Welcome to you both. Gilbert Doctorow, let me first start with you. We are looking at protests that are happening on a weekly basis at a minimum. Some of the countries that we are seeing the protests occur in frequently are places like France and the UK. Now we're looking at Spain, which is not obviously their first time people coming out to protest involving teachers and healthcare professionals, the one we're looking at. But what is your assessment when you keep hearing and witnessing these strikes that are happening in Europe? In this case in point, we're looking at Spain and also Italy to be the latest.
Well, the strikes are about different issues in different countries. There is a commonality of cost of living crisis across Europe, but that has not resulted in a commonality of strike movements and protest movements. In France, the protests have been enormous, but they were about a local issue, a French issue of raising the pension age. You've just remarked on strikes of teachers and health workers in Spain. That, again, is a local issue that is driven by the local conditions. Here in Belgium, we had strikes this past Monday. I don't know that your journalists were aware of it because they were strictly a local issue. But they brought out four of the largest unions in the country, and all of the public transport in Brussels was greatly disturbed, if not shut down, as a result of strikes. For what purpose? The strikes were about the changeover by one of the largest supermarket chains in Belgium, Delhaize, who are disposing of their assets and franchising out their 100 or plus stores across the country. And this is protested by the labor unions because the new franchisees are going to change the work rules and compensation and so forth. So the whole protest was about what's called social dumping. But the point I want to make is that the commonality of the problem, which comes across the EU from the very poor judgment of the leadership of the EU countries with respect to the war in Ukraine and the imposition of sanctions, which are self-destructive for the economies of Europe, that is not a cut up across the board in any of the countries. So the not to mention the fact that the threats and the risks to peace and security and to the survival, indeed, of these countries, if the war expands, as it's on a track to do, that is not discussed. We're living in a fool's paradise, and that is terribly regrettable. I see no opposition movements of any kind to the inevitable evolution of this war from a Ukraine-Russia war to a European-wide war.
Okay. Clive Menzies, I'm sure you have a deep analysis on this. You know, when you take a look at a country like Spain, I have to group that. Well, I don't have to, but I want to group that with Italy and France in terms of the debt that they're carrying. It's quite high. Greece is the number one, but Italy, 147.3% of the GDP. Then Portugal, and then Spain, 115.6%, and France, 113.4%. The reason why I'm putting these countries together and ask you as to, the fact that this is not about just the Ukraine war. Prior to this, you had COVID-19, and prior to that, you had the countries that were struggling. And, of course, we can go back to the 2008 financial crisis, where we haven't really looked at the countries recuperating from that economic mess back then.
Indeed. Good evening, Kelly. Undoubtedly, we were predicting at least a decade ago that we were heading for some sort of disaster, and we were pretty public about it in the city and elsewhere from about 2015. And a lot of this is driven by money supply. There is a massive oversupply of money in the major economies, and that there is a price to be paid for that. And we're also seeing the final throes of plunder. In the UK, the amount of money that is being harvested off individuals, groups, sections of society for driving, for all sorts of things, plunder is full on. We said last year we're heading into crazy times. We're now in those crazy times, and it is all driven by money. But it is actually, we do have a way out of this, and we also have the building blocks already in front of us. But maybe I'll come back to that later.
Okay, yeah, definitely we want to hear what those building blocks are. All right, so, Gilbert Doctor, you talked about the Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. I'd like to find out from you if you can tell us whether the EU is actually living almost at the present when it comes to their energy supplies. The reason why I ask that is back in December of 2022, von der Leyen, the European Commission president, said, we have managed to withstand Russia's energy blackmail with our RE Power EU plan to reduce demand. She talked about 300 billion euros worth of investments. The result is that we are safe for this winter. So that's for the winter of 2022. But when you take a look at what's going to happen for 2023 and then the next winter after that, Europe as a whole does not have enough energy reserves, if I'm correct to say that. And they're kind of go as they plan or plan as they go. I'm not too sure what the phrase is. Are they aware what they're dealing with when they're supporting the Ukraine war as they have been, as to what they're dealing with in terms of maybe coming up short with energy and how disastrous that would be?
Well, even the Financial Times and articles in the last couple of weeks have dealt with this issue and have come up with the findings that, yes, Europe has saved 15 or 20% in its annual consumption of gas, and how wonderful that is. And yet, in 2023 and 2024, they still will be required to import 10, 20, 30%, oh, well, not 30, but 20% of their gas supplies from Russia by one means or another. Still, the issue is not whether they can heat houses. The issue is whether they can maintain industry. Despite the fact that, yes, they covered the needs and the population did not go cold in this past winter, partly thanks to a mild winter, the fact remains that industry began moving out of Europe. This was most notable in Europe's largest manufacturer and exporter of industrial goods, Germany. The Financial Times, again, is a very useful source because they are not interested in showing crisis. On the contrary, they're interested in showing stability. And they have remarked on how the German Mittelstand, the medium-sized family-owned companies, are moving to Switzerland and to Sweden because of the high price of energy in Germany. Now, the larger companies are moving to the States. Bayer Leverkusen announced maybe 6 months ago that they are disinvesting in Germany and moving production capacity to the States, where energy is cheaper. There are whole sections of industry which cannot maintain a competitive product in the environment that we have now and are likely to continue to have, even if Europe's leaders say they are covering the needs. not at a price that industry can afford. The glass industry is one, metallurgy is another. This all has an impact on jobs and on the population at large. But the single biggest issue is not power right now. The single biggest issue in the cost of living problem and deterioration of living standards is in food. Again, 2 weeks ago, the UK reported that food inflation for the past year has been on average 18%. That is average. In given food categories, whether it's dairy or vegetables or whatever, if it goes up to 50% or even 100%, this is something that the average working man feels every time they go shopping. And it takes out of his pocket an important amount of money that otherwise would go to enjoying life. Here in Belgium, my wife is a member of a women's club of professional women, retired women, but women who have had comfortable lives by their husband's income and by their own income. And they are complaining around the dinner table that they're shocked at the prices here in Belgium, and still more shocked when some of them who have relations in London and go back and forth visit the UK. This is something that wealthy people are complaining about and poor people are suffering from at a great deterioration of the living standards.
Okay. All right, let's go to the building blocks that you talked about, Clive Menzies. Go ahead.
Well, the thing is, before the adoption of money, we operated on the basis of knowing and trusting all those within the community with whom we dealt. Money was a very useful mechanism to deal with people outside the community where you didn't have access to data. There wasn't a means to understand what those needs and capacities of those communities were. However, we're now in the age where companies like Google, Amazon, eBay, Microsoft, Facebook have got huge volumes of data that are analogous to the sort of data that we used to carry about who was buying what, who was friends with who was good at what. All of that information is now being stored. The only difference is it's being monetized. If we open source that big data, then we don't need money. And most of these problems that we see that result from competition would switch into cooperation, and we'd live in a world of miraculous abundance. Now, that sounds like utopia, but if you bear in mind that the current system works in direct contradiction to our interests, what our needs and capacities, what we need to fulfill our capacities to be able to do things, has nothing to do with money. Money has a completely separate valuation that causes conflict and causes wars and competition and all the rest of it. We have the building blocks to change the way we live, and it could happen very quickly because the power of the internet is making transformation at record speed, and more people are looking at this idea of, instead of focusing on money, let's focus on the data. And if you look at Amazon Fresh, you walk in, you walk out, okay, money changes hands at your bank account, but what is most important in all that transaction is the data about people, what they can do, what they need, and we can satisfy everybody's needs. We have more than enough resources in the world to feed, clothe, house everyone more than once, and all we need is a different system, because this one clearly doesn't work and it's breaking. And if we don't think of something different, then more and more people are going to die, more and more people are going to suffer hardship, and the problems that your other guests referred to will just continue.
Sure.
We just need to think differently.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, I think that has actually happened, Gilbert Doctorow, the whole thinking differently process. I think the WEF back a couple years ago talked about this transformation that needs to take place. And, of course, green energy has been something that's been propelled. Well, the U.S. seems to have taken a leading role. But given what has happened with the energy crisis, which stemmed from, in one sense, from the Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, countries are reverting back to the old sources of energy. So it's not having that impact. And based on this particular source that was researched for this program, when it comes to the fact where we talk about protests, it says protests over food and fuel surged in 2022, the biggest were in Europe, which has continued in 2023, and it blamed soaring energy prices, whereas to contrast to a decade ago, it said food prices were to blame. So this transformation has fallen flat, right?
I'm afraid I don't quite follow your question.
Well, the transformation that they've talked about hasn't happened because you have an energy crisis, the thirst for energy. And to go green is not, it seems like the infrastructure is not really in place. But countries, economies need to obviously move. The wheels need to be in motion. So they're reverting, they're not really moving away from oil. They're going back to coal countries like China, I could even say. And therefore, this whole green transformation is not happening. I'm trying to relate that to what Clive Menzies said in terms of the new approach that needs to take place.
Well, the green movement has made enormous traction in the last couple of years. And, of course, the attempts to cut gas consumption has been a factor here in the last year in the new enthusiasm of the population at large for placing the electric or heating generating panels on roofs. And the whole public is deeply involved in discussing it at home and with friends. At the same time, I can tell you that here in Belgium and in Germany, I know from colleagues there, that the price of firewood has doubled and tripled in the last year. So not only are we not going back to coal, but people are heating their homes with firewood. Now, you tell me, please, is that progress or is that a reversion to energy sources that we thought had long been abandoned?
Okay, so Clive Menzies, the protest that happened in Spain, it was reported to be in the tens of thousands. I believe it was 70,000 to 120,000 altogether. You had maybe less numbers in Italy, but you had some of the biggest that have happened in France, where it was a million months ago. And you have these protests. I think Belgium was in the tens of thousands also, if I'm correct.
Yes.
When is the time where you think that, and the fact that Gilbert Doctorow, our guest in Brussels, said that the food problem is really at an elevated state at this point, where people are feeling the pinch of the rising inflation of food. When do you think that threshold is going to pass, where people are going to say enough is enough, and that governments are going to feel threatened in order for them to have to react?
Well, I'd say the die is already cast. From what I see locally and around the world, is more and more people waking up to what the Great Reset and the Green Agenda are all about. The carbon reduction they're talking about is people, and people are awakening to that, and they are making alternative arrangements. And so when does this happen? I felt that the tide turned in 2022. There is a rising recognition of the corruption, the criminality, the outright genocide and greed that is just taking place in plain sight. The fact that it's not reported in the main media doesn't really matter, because in social media it's gaining ground. The truth resonates far more strongly than the lies, which need constant maintenance. So I think we are in the beginning of a major seismic change of the way human society operates. And the Great Reset is analogous to Stalin's five-year plans, the Chinese cultural Great Leap Forward, where they are genocidal plans which never work. And people are aware of that. and they're working locally, creating alternatives for health, food, knowledge, information, all sorts of things. People are beginning to help each other rather than relying on the criminal institutions that are now so blatantly greedy and looking to harvest every cent, dollar, penny, euro that they can get their hands on. So we're in crazy times, but new things are emerging, and that is what news programs like this one ought to be looking at, because that's where the future is, rather than the sort of final death throes of a dying system.
Okay, thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. That's Clive Menzies, political economy researcher and analyst from London. Thank you. And Gilbert Doctorow, thank you so much. Independent international affairs analyst from Brussels. We had Jerome Hughes, a correspondent from Brussels, at the top of the program. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitale and the team. It's goodbye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزای لازمی است
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones
اما این کافی نیست
But it's not enough نقیم الدین و لا
تتفرقوا فی مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن دوری از قرآن از قرآن
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran 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 کتاب
In the limelight.
In Louisiana, United States, racial discrimination and fear are putting women's and babies' lives at risk. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster NBC News has covered this story and tells us more. A Louisiana hospital sent a mom home with prayers while she was miscarrying. Caitlin Joshua was given an ultrasound at Women's Hospital in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. They examined and monitored her. That's where she says the treatment ended. And so I said, okay, so is this a miscarriage? And the young lady, she said, I can't really tell. I can't really tell you right now. I don't know. And I said, well, what do you mean? What do you know? You did the ultrasound, Joshua said. I recall her saying, we're just sending you home with prayers. We're going to hope for the best. Meanwhile, a hospital spokesman in Baton Rouge said, it's complex when diagnosis of early pregnancy loss is unclear. The standard of care is to wait. The next day, when bleeding and cramping became unbearable, Joshua sought help from a second hospital, the Baton Rouge General Hospital, where a doctor ordered another ultrasound. She said straight up, this doesn't look like a baby at all. Are you sure you were ever pregnant? This just looks like a cyst. At both hospitals, Joshua said medical care providers avoided directly responding to her questions about whether she was miscarrying. Joshua said her discharge papers only noted potential miscarriage. I just have to believe, and I know, that it is just the vagueness of the abortion ban in the state that's caused so much fear around physicians doing their jobs, Caitlin Joshua said. A spokesman for Baton Rouge General Hospital said every patient is different. They said that since the abortion ban began, they have not changed the way they manage miscarriage or the options available to treat them. The hospital's discharge instructions left Joshua with one option, to take Tylenol and monitor for worsening symptoms. Since the new law was implemented, banning abortions in most cases, many physicians in Louisiana have been afraid to provide care typically used to treat miscarriage, a surgical procedure or a pill, because those same methods are used in abortions and can now be seen as illegal in Louisiana, potentially landing healthcare providers in prison. The U.S. national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Racial discrimination fear in Louisiana are putting women's and babies' lives at risk. A Louisiana hospital recently sent a mom home with prayers saying that while she was miscarrying, they could not do anything for her. Getting maternal care in Louisiana was already challenging before the law passed. The U.S. holds the sad distinction of having one of the highest rates of pregnancy-related deaths in the developed world, according to the World Health Organization, WHO. Women in the United States are 10 or more times likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than mothers in Poland, Spain, or Norway. Some of the worst statistics come out of the southern United States, where deep pockets of poverty, healthcare deserts, and racial discrimination have long put women and their babies' lives at greater risk. Where you live can heighten the risk. A third of Louisiana's 64 parishes are maternal healthcare deserts without a single obstetric provider, according to the March of Dimes. More than 51,000 women in Louisiana are left without easy access to healthcare. They are three times more likely to die of pregnancy-related causes, according to a Tulane University study published in Women's Health Issues. Doctors are scarce in Assumption Parish, Louisiana, a rural county of 21,000. Mums Teresa Dubois and Brittany Cavalier, both expecting their third child, need to travel 45 minutes to the nearest pediatrician and up to an hour 35 minutes to get to the closest hospital. Doctors, advocates, and mothers are leading the charge to improve maternal health care conditions across Louisiana. Dr. Rebecca G., an obstetrician, formerly State Secretary of Health and founder of Nest Health, a primary health service for families, has spent her career advocating for better maternal care in Louisiana. As Secretary of Health, Dr. Rebecca G. worked with the state board that reviews every maternal death in Louisiana. The board found that 80% of all pregnancy-related deaths in Louisiana were potentially preventable. 39 out of every 100,000 mothers die during or shortly after childbirth in the state of Louisiana, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.